Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
He's round the goalkeeper, he's done it! Absolutely incredible!
He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter who was without a shadow of a doubt giving him lip.
Tame again.
Break up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
The precise thought process behind a switch of international footballing allegiance, even weirder theories about the late 1990s Premier League obsession with Vicks Vapor Rub, the very modern power struggle between trained stewards and elite players when someone invades the pitch for a selfie, players with a museum to themselves in their own house, and the futility of remonstrating with a fourth official, who for some reason is always Craig Pawson. Brought to your ears by The Athletic, this is Football Clichés. Hello everyone and welcome to episode 245 of Football Clichés. I'm Adam Hurry, and with me for this Mesut Haaland Dix by my side is Nick Miller. How's it going?
Hello Adam, yeah, very well. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. Just to refresh people's memory of the Nick Miller Athletic experience, here are the last couple of headlines of the pieces you've written. A history of Premier League hat-tricks, the good, the bad and the lucky. And Armenia versus Turkey is not just about football, it's about a bloody history, about genocide. Brilliant stuff. The ultimate cross-section of the Nick Miller experience, I think.
Yes, some people think my work lacks kind of direction and focus, but I won't hear of it personally.
Excellent.
Don't forget the piece I wrote a few months ago about sitting in his service station for the whole day. That's also kind of very much fits with the oeuvre.
Yeah, that's right smack bang in the middle of the spectrum there, isn't it? Yeah, that's pure Athletic. No genocide on today's episode of Mesut Haaland Dix, but we do have a YouTuber. How are you doing? It's Max Fosh, comedian, YouTubesman, and perhaps more crucially, Max, three-time DMer asking to do Mesut Haaland Dix. Welcome.
Yeah, this is very embarrassing, Adam. And do you know what? I completely accept that because I have been ruthlessly just pestering you to get on this podcast. It is my favorite. It is the top of the charts every single time Spotify rap comes around. And I thought, if I can get anything out of this so-called social media clout, it must be an appearance on Mesut Haaland Dix.
I will be milking your social media clout. It's a two-way thing. Don't you worry about that. You're talking to us all the way from Las Vegas. This feels a bit like when GMTV sort of threw over to someone in LA for the showbiz gossip. This is the depths we've plumbed.
Is it depths? Or, I mean, are our kind of personal situations more depths than this one?
I would say so.
By comparison.
Yeah, Las Vegas beats Zone 4 London, no question. But Max, yeah, you're in Las Vegas for your literal sins.
My literal sins, the sin city. I mean, this is kind of where commentators just would love to come to just find out a little bit more about sins. But yes, I'm here in Las Vegas for my sins. I am filming a couple of videos out here, which are going to be coming out quite soon. And hopefully the Wi-Fi stays strong enough for us to continue this.
The Wi-Fi is clinging on for dear life. If you think Las Vegas Wi-Fi would be better, frankly. I'm disgusted.
He's even much better.
Let's do this anyway. Let's have a quick adjudication panel because some very pressing international break information has come to my attention. Nick, it's the most basic information in football, really. It's among the most fundamental pieces of information that football regularly needs to communicate, but has somehow become a complete mess. I'm talking to you about league tables and actually specifically group tables, the graphics of group tables by various media outlets and social media accounts. It's a complete mess. listener Adam Nathan got in touch, and this is a mid-range offence, really. But the official graphics for the European Championship qualifiers puts the points first, and then uses an M instead of P for played, so it's matches. The whole thing's a shambles. How can you keep getting it wrong?
What is wrong with these people? Mm. I mean, why would you put the points first?
I know.
I mean, is there is there a particular reason for it, or have we just become conditioned to it over the years?
Yeah, is there a space issue? Yeah, like, are they only able to put two things into the graphics? So they've just kind of, I mean, like, I agree with you, it's an absolute mess, but I'm trying to think of any reason why they would decide to put to
all
just
the
do
information
that.
Is there. All the information is there. They've just done it in the wrong order, and I'm disgusted. But I mean, it gets worse, Max. I mean, the official England team account put out a graphic of the group as it stood after the win over Ukraine, and it's just a mess of fonts and it's. It's not user-friendly, and I feel like someone with your international clout should be doing something about this, frankly.
Yeah, my issue when it comes to tables, this is mainly directed at BBC Sport, is that BBC Sport decides on their tables who is important enough to be bold. Mm. So there's kind of a link that you can click through to a page about that country.
Right.
And so suddenly, obviously, all the home nations are in bold. You've got your Argentinas, Germany's, but Slovenia and Armenia doesn't quite seem to take the biscuit, because obviously somebody at BBC Sport can't be bothered to write up a little piece on Slovenia or Armenia.
It's just not SEO friendly, that's just how it is.
BBC Sport have also been guilty, I don't know if it is true now, in the past, of doing they will have the table and they will have the total points, but they will have home and then away, but not the combined thing, which again is an absolute travesty.
Yeah. I mourn kind of the standard home and away league table. You have to really dig for those these days. Not that I'm massively interested, but it would be nice to have it at my fingertips. Right. Max Vos, you are here finally after essentially begging on Twitter.
Yeah, this is begging. No, I'm not going to say that I didn't beg, because that's exactly what this is. And I've had this in my notes for ages, so I'm very excited to get involved, get started.
Yeah, you're not alone in that. And I have to say, I'm smitten by the idea that people do have these lists sort of squirreled away, you know, for one day they might, you know, find themselves on the hallowed turf of Mesut Haaland Dix. But let's do this. Let's delve into your fascinations, first of all. Tell us about your first fascination of football.
My first fascination of football is probably the conversation that will invariably happen. This must happen when a player is being overlooked by their national team. They're probably 23, 24, 25. They're realizing they might have played a few games for England B, and they kind of realize, okay, I'm not going to be playing for my national team here. So they must just get out the family tree and start to seeing which footballing association they can call to try and get some international football. Mm. I love this idea that they're kind of, oh, I don't think mum's got any kind of ancestors from Hungary, but I'll give her a call. And then it just, that invariably leads to players playing for countries that you are absolutely flabbergasted as to how they've got a cap. I mean, my favorite one in that is Danny Higginbottom pulling on the shirt of Gibraltar.
Yes.
For a couple of caps. Mm. In the mid 2010s. Like, did he go on holiday once to Gibraltar? How is Danny Higginbottom able to justify that he should play for Gibraltar?
That is a very interesting example, actually, Nick, because in all the kind of landscape of players playing for unlikely countries, it felt like Higginbotham was just doing them a favour. I've got more of an overwhelming vibe of that than I've ever had from players turning out for random countries.
Yeah, it had a very, very much kind of retired pro turns out for mates team, in Sunday League or whatever vibe to it. Mm.
Yeah, that's real. Can you just nip down to the Rock of Gibraltar and just pull a shirt on for us, mate? We're short this week.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a European ringer kind of thing.
Yeah. But Max, the scenario that you paint here is an interesting one, because you're suggesting that it's the players who are doing the bidding here, sort of dialing up potential, you know, grandfather qualified federations and saying, can I play for you? And I don't think it happens that way around, but I really want it to be.
Well, yeah, in my mind, it's like a UCAS clearing situation. You've kind of got your top five universities Oxford have said no, so you're kind of calling up Birmingham on an insurance, but just swap Birmingham for a kind of an Eastern European football team or country.
I think possibly telling of our respective backgrounds that you've gone for Birmingham as the absolute, the lowest of the low, kind of the real scum that you may have to lower yourself to.
Yeah, lean into the elite.
No, I did.
It's fine.
No, absolutely. No, I did Birmingham. I placed my heart for Birmingham because they were actually one of the ones that did say yes. I was only accepted for Newcastle and Birmingham. So Birmingham is my Gibraltar.
Nice.
How provincial.
Pure Barclays universities. That's what I love to see. All right, Max, do you qualify for any other nations?
No, I did. I mean, when I was younger, I played cricket to a semi-serious level, and I'm half Dutch, so I did look up whether the Dutch cricket team were any good, and they were just on this precipice of just being a bit too professional for me to even contemplate kind of working my socks off and having a chance. So I think the Dutch national cricket team was the closest that I got to.
Oh, I would have loved to have introduced you as Dutch cricket ace Max Vosch. That would have been even more of a sell for people who didn't know who you were. That would be brilliant. But the tipping point here, Nick, is fascinating to me about players sort of realizing that they're not going to play for their designated number one nation for all sorts of reasons. And I find it interesting to try and detect the motivation in a player who eventually switches allegiance, because it's a bit like, and I don't think this is weird to say, I think it's a bit like dropping down the divisions in club football. It's basically saying, okay, I'm not going to get, as Max points out, my number one choice. I'm going to drop down. But whilst I'm not big on national pride, Nick, I kind of completely see how a player might just be like, I really want to try international football and I want to find the easiest route into it rather than be selected.
Yeah, and I think that the most kind of recent example of this is Matty Cash, who is quite a young guy. He was he's born in England. I think he's through his mother.
Yeah,
I think either his mother's Polish or there's Polish descent on that side. But there must have been a tipping point, a point there where he obviously England have a lot of right backs. So he must have just thought, well, England have got a lot of right backs, so I'm not going to play. So I might as well switch my allegiance to Poland instead.
Maybe it comes down to pathways, Max. Maybe players do, you would assume, sort of look at the bigger picture and say, well, okay, yeah, we do have, you know, a real surfeit of right-backs these days. And maybe they do look at the bigger picture like that. And that's probably quite a clever thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, I also quite like that they're kind of counting on their fingers, kind of almost like someone at a party. So we've got Trent, we've got Reese, who else are we? And I just kind of going there, kind of like number fifth or sixth. And I thought, oh yeah, that's probably not going to be me, is it? And okay, right, let's just call up the Polish FA then. But also, it seems like these players then just really they seem very grateful for the opportunity, and then we see Berrettón Díaz just adding Diaz to the end of his name as a way, as kind of, it's almost like a thank you very much, I really appreciate it. And you kind of get Matty Cash eating some Polish sausage on in a magazine just so he can say that, oh yeah, no lads, I'm one of you, I am Polish.
That was a very, very pertinent point, because Jack Pierce writes in and says these sort of switches of allegiance, the more dramatic switches of allegiance, Nick, always include like a photo of a said player sampling the local cuisine. Think Matty Cash in front of a plate of pierogies, or Eric Young biting into a Welsh cake. I think that's a stretch.
It is, and you've got to be very careful. I know this wasn't an international thing, but you could get very close to Benito Carboni pretending to eat an uncooked pizza when after signing for Sheffield Wednesday territory there.
And that was already quite gauche at club level. To do it at international level, I think would actually be quite offensive to the people you're trying to ingratiate yourself with. So it's a tricky art, Max. But I think, you know, there are bread and butter responsibilities when it comes to switching allegiance. Like, you've got to learn the anthem, because that's what players are always asked. Or, have you learned the anthem yet? And maybe some players are like, I don't give a shit.
You've got to learn the anthem.
Yeah. Do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they've got to learn the anthem, absolutely. They've got to be able to do a very a short interview, which includes a few words of the native language. Yeah. Doesn't have to be much, but so they can give a wry smile and kind of say, "Yeah, look, I've tried. I'm trying. Don't worry." But for some of the countries as well, if it's a player that's potentially a lot better than kind of the standard that the country plays at, Do they, I feel like I'm getting this wrong, but do they sometimes, they almost kind of have like a club unveiling, like a Camp Nou, yeah, welcome to the national team kind of thing, which really doesn't sit very, it doesn't sit well with me.
And it always makes me think, Nick, that what do the other players think? The players who have sort of really sort of toiled away with that one option for that country, work their way up into the national team from whatever league they're playing in, and this bloke just rocks up. Generally, they tend to welcome them, but I suspect there's a bit of, what the fuck are you doing here, mate?
Yeah, I feel like this is where the initiation song really comes into its own, and the posting of it by by welcoming teammates. If you see the welcome song or the initiation song being posted by multiple teammates on Instagram or whatever, you think, okay, well they must have accepted him.
Yeah,
I think that's probably fine.
That is the benchmark.
If you don't. Yeah, if you don't hear it, then you fear for them. You really do.
Once again, visions of Max Fosch's Dutch cricket initiation ceremony in a parallel universe. It could have happened. I'm not letting it go.
It could have happened. I mean, it might still happen, Adam. But
right.
Actually, to go back quickly to what you said up there, and like other players welcoming them, does that mean there's kind of like this ongoing butterfly effect where the fourth choice right back for that country is now kind of opening up the family tree to see where they can go?
We should
see.
It just
is never ending until...
We should track this. We should definitely track this. Like players who've been displaced by someone who's switched countries and see how far they go. Yeah, exactly. The domino effect.
And where do they all end up? Where's the last base country that everyone seems to turn to?
Poor bloke turning out for San Marino. I had no choice. They pushed me down here. There it is. Right, Max, strong start. Tell us about your second fascination of football, please.
My second fascination and love of football is the power that players have over stewards when a fan runs onto a pitch. And because there's this moment where the fan breaks through the line of the stewards. Mm. They get to, let's say, Messi, and this fan is being chased by three or four stewards. And then the stewards get to the fan who is kind of like with Messi trying to get a picture. And they kind of look to the player as to, right, what do we do now? What's our job now? Are we meant to take this person away? And then there's this kind of moment where the player has to almost become this omnipotent being where he kind of puts its arm around the fan and say, no, come with me. Don't worry. It's okay. We can get the picture. So there's almost this threshold in which the fan needs to get through, like on the pitch before there's like a proximity to the player in which it's okay for them to be on the pitch. But I just love this moment where the stewards kind of are looking at a professional footballer who also doesn't really know what to do,
yep,
but is quite conscious that there's like the world's media watching them. So they kind of have to be like, yeah, okay, yeah, of course, here, nice to meet you, how are you doing, let's get a pic.
Max is absolutely right here, Nick. There are two main concepts that collide in this very modern situation, actually, because, you know, it's player power, first of all, manifesting itself in a way that we never reconceived of before, which is, you know, that they're suddenly in charge. And secondly, there's a classy touch aspect to this. You know, as Max says, this is a very public thing and it tends to be very elite players who don't want their reputations tarnished. But beyond all that, people used to be bundled off the pitch unceremoniously in these situations. Now it's a very grey area and I'm very concerned. What level of player...
Game's gone.
It has, to a certain extent. But Nick, what level of player do you think you're going to go down to where the situation is taken out of their hands? A steward would look at him and go, nah, you don't deserve this. Come on, let's get off. Is it Matty Cash again?
Well, I mean... It might be Matty Cash. Yeah. It's become one of those things where, like, the first few times you saw your Messis, your Ronaldos or whatever do that, it was very much classy touch. It's now got to the point where a player would be a dick if they didn't do that. It's like it's now become the sort of expected thing, like giving your shirt to someone in the crowd who's held up a little sign that says please can I have your shirt. You kind of, it feels like you get judged if you don't do it. What was once a classy touch is now the norm.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, I mean, there's obviously a clear strategy, Max, to fans, you know, picking the right moment to jump on the pitch and ask a player for a selfie. It's usually mid-game as well. It's not always kind of after the final whistle. I guess it depends on the magnitude of the game. But, you know, woe betide a young fan who runs onto the pitch and asks Messi or Ronaldo for a picture when they're losing. Like, I mean, I don't think he would get the same welcome.
Also they also, I think obviously they're so conscious of the kind of the classy touch element, where there's an age limit as well, in which the player almost, like, if they're young enough, the player has to do it no matter what.
Clearly.
But then there's a question of, like, if they are like 8, that means that whoever the guardian they're with has kind of egged them on to do it. And this is kind of like, yeah, go on. Okay, now's your time. Okay, run. Which is a really bizarre concept, kind of sending your child out to the wolves to essentially, you know, it could go quite wrong. They could be kind of, I don't know, not locked up, but get in quite a lot of trouble.
And a lifetime ban, a lifetime stadium ban is going to mean more to an 8-year-old than it is to like a 52-year-old.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I always do wonder when it's kind of somebody, a child who looks quite young, who's running out. But I think you need to very much kind of pick your moment and judge the mood of the game. Like you are running onto the pitch, but yeah, you say you need to make sure your player's either winning or drawing, because losing, they'll kind of, I mean, what do they do? What does a player do when they don't really want? Well, because they'll see them coming from a mile off. Well, 200 yards off. What will the player do to kind of say, no, not now? Is it a handout? Is it kind of what do they do?
I actually think there's some transferable skills here, Nick. It's probably the same motion that a player does to get an opponent off the pitch when they're taking ages to be substituted. It's a very sort of gentle, can you just fuck off?
Well, this is the other thing, because the when a fan enters the pitch, there are whole new rules are applied to the players, not just in the kind of welcoming them and, you know, shoving the stewards aside, going, no, let them have a picture. But this is obviously more if it's an adult. But when a fan comes onto the pitch, complete license is given to players who just want to sort of knock them about a bit. Years ago, remember Ian Walker, when a fan invaded the pitch, I think it was at Leicester, just shoved the guy to the ground and was sort of on the verge of sticking the boot in as well. And then Sam Kerr, when she tripped up that pitch invader a couple of years ago and was kind of roundly applauded for giving the, the guy what for.
You're definitely allowed one. I think I would go for a kind of aggressive trip, like a proper sort of hack. But not a full hack, just in case any injuries
are
actually
inflicted. You've got to kind of judge there and then whether that person, like everyone in the stadium, wants to see that person fall over or get hurt. Yeah. You're not allowed one if they're 12.
No,
but it's sensational. The first player to misjudge it and just preemptively leather someone in the face because they think they're running on to cause them harm when actually they just wanted a selfie.
Yeah, it's quite Michael Owen behaviour when he was kind of slotting them past that goalkeeper who was about 8.
13, I believe history has judged. Nick, let's dwell on the most pertinent example of this, which is Lionel Messi, because it feels like barely an international break goes by without a picture of a kind of puzzled, annoyed looking Messi in the midst of a selfie saga with a kind of opposition fan who's taken this one once in a lifetime moment to get a picture with him. But I kind of have to sit on the other side of the fence as well. I do get it. I mean, imagine how prized that photo would be in the grand scheme of photos you could ever get. The number of different places you would post that photo simultaneously.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, even as they more and more of these things happen, and you would think the currency of them diminishes because there are so many of them. There's no, you know, it's one thing to collar a footballer at a restaurant or something like that and get a picture with them, but if it's actually, you know, on the pitch mid-game, that's priceless stuff.
Why do they always have a flag? they always have the flag of the, like, I don't know, I just, when you said Messi, Adam, it just made me think they've always got an Argentinian flag.
And then I think
that's just to yeah, I guess so. But then what I love is always the look on the face of the fan when they do get up close to Messi. This is mainly more a Messi and Ronaldo thing, where it's just one of total awe and wonderment, as if they weren't expecting when they got closer for them to, I don't know, look like that. But it is like a genuine just awe of their presence.
Well, Messi's a bit smaller than I expected. That sort of awe, that sort of mid-range. I knew he was small, but I didn't realise. Yeah, fantastic. Okay, we asked our listeners for the lengths that they've gone to, Nick, to get photos with footballers. And this was the standout from North Bank TS. He says, pre-smartphones, as a child, I saw Dennis Bergkamp in the Friary Park Cafe in Finchley demolishing a full English. We'll talk about that in a second. I ran home to my nan's to get the camera, but my bubble was burst arriving back and he'd already left. Well, he was putting it away by the sounds of it. I mean, let's talk about this first. The concept of Bergkamp, Nick, demolishing a full English really does eat away at his reputation in my eyes.
Yeah, because he's kind of... He obviously signed before Wenger, but you associate him with the this is when we discovered pasta and broccoli era of football nutrition. demolishing a full English.
That wasn't his autobiography, was it?
No, absolutely not. And there's stillness and speed, indeed. Yeah. Well, yeah, he calls to mind that picture. You've seen that picture of Pete Doherty, who's eating one of those kind of challenge breakfast things. And he just looks a complete mess. I can't picture Bergkamp. I'm not doubting the veracity of this story, but it's really difficult to picture.
Well, let's also pick up, Max, on the point of pre-smartphones. I mean, if we go back 30 years, let's say, about the obstacles that would have faced a fan in those situations, like about dragging a Polaroid onto the pitch and then having to wait for it to develop. You're going to get dragged off in that time, mate. You can't even show, you won't be able to show Bergkamp the photo there, mate.
Basically just like fanning the Polaroid just quicker and quicker as the stewards get closer and closer just to see he's got the shot. Oh yeah, I do actually. No, sorry. Can we just do another one? But yeah, the Bergkamp demolishing a full English breakfast. I mean, that opens up a whole realm of possibility of conversation about which player is the most likely to do a food challenge because it makes it sound quite like that. But yeah, Nick, you're right. Is Bergkamp kind of the last bastion or that kind of last generation of player before the pasta and broccoli before a game?
I think of I don't know, just sort of sticking to the Arsenal thing, but Ray Parlour seems like the most likely to take on some kind of food challenge, I think.
He's invincible. He's impenetrable.
Yeah.
Like, no matter how much he drinks or what he eats, he still looks like he retired about 3 years ago, precisely 3 years ago. Fair play to him. Fair play to him. He'd do well in Vegas. Anyway, right, Max, your third fascination of football, please.
My third fascination of football, and this is a genuine fascination rather than a love of football when I was growing up, and that is Vicks Vapor Rub.
Good tailoring. Well done.
Thank you very much. That is what my entire career has led up to that moment. Because when I was growing up, the Invincible season, like 2000, early 2000s, I was probably seven or eight. And I remember seeing a couple of them, Vieira and Laurent as well, I think a couple of times, which just had this little patch on their chest. And for ages, I genuinely had no idea what it was. And like you're 7 and 8, you don't really know how to find out this information. So there was all sorts of kind of rumors that would go around. I mean, I spoke to my brother-in-law about this and he said he used to think it was yogurt as a child. And I have no idea why a player would rub a Müller corner onto their shirt. But it was seeing Vieira with that Vicks Vapor Rub. It was like that makes them an elite player. Like, oh, if only I had some Vicks Vapor Rub, then I would also be able to boss the park at Highbury. And it's kind of a wider fascination of especially, this is again, the mid to early 2000s. You don't see it much anymore, although you do with the holes in the socks, the back of the socks. That's another conversation. But these little quirks that players used to do to perceivingly give them an advantage. Like my favourite one was Rushdu, the Turkish goalkeeper. He used to put black strips under his eyes.
Incredible,
in a very kind of NFL kind of way. I think to reduce glare off his own skin. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've never had glare off my own skin before. But as a child, I thought, yes, that is why he's an incredible goalkeeper. It's the black strips. Of course it is.
Yeah, I'm convinced my shiny head has actually held my football career back, frankly. That's what it was. Actually, the yogurt thing is interesting, Nick. I mean, I have fond memories on this podcast of our previously aired and widely ridiculed theory that it was actually glue on the chest to make the ball stick to Vieira's chest, which actually
I would have totally believed that.
Yeah.
I would have totally believed that if I've heard that when I was younger.
What kind of properties do you think yogurt has, Max, to lend itself to performance enhancing, legal performance enhancing in football?
I don't think there's none that can spring to mind. The only way I can think of is that they've had a yogurt before the game and someone's just slipped down the front. They thought, oh, go on then, I'll just leave it.
And there's a bigger
patch. Yeah, just rubbed it.
Yeah, awful.
But Vieira seems to have done that every single game. Yeah. I don't know why.
Superstition. There you are. Nick, I'm tempted on my next Sunday League appearance to resurrect all the 1990s, 2000 marginal gains gimmicks simultaneously. I mean, what a sight that would be. Nasal strip. Vicks on the chest.
Yeah, absolutely.
Socks above the knee, which I'm not sure counts as a performance-enhancing thing, but so many players were doing it, so it feels like it must have had some sort of functional thing. Naturally, sweat-wicking technology in my shirt and shorts. Can't beat a bit of sweat-wicking, which is so important in football. And I would top it off with the admittedly April Fool's Day gimmick, which was the Adidas Predator headband. What a sight that would be. I'd be fully kitted out.
What about Jim Leighton used to sort of cake Vaseline over his eyebrows? The theory being that
like a boxer.
Yeah, a little bit. I think the theory being that it would stop sweat from getting into his eyes.
I believe it was yogurt, Nick. Clear yogurt.
I mean, also Adam, you could go for the one that was most easily accessible to me as a schoolboy was a white socks over the socks that you were playing football in that just went up to your ankles. It was as if it looked a little bit like you had tape down there for your Achilles injury that was just, you know, feeling a bit tender.
I was a firm white sock wearer, definitely. It was just pure aesthetics, Nick. It made you feel like a mid 2000s Premier League footballer.
Yeah, cycling shorts underneath football shorts as well. That was kind of big in the early mid 90s.
But yeah, those are the marginal gains.
If you wanted to really go for it now, you could go for the classic bra that they a lot of the football
oh the GPS bra
hate.
Yeah,
the GPS bra. I don't know how you could be able to just like pass that off at Sunday League as to why you're wearing a GPS bra, but I think it does make you seem quite elite. Just having that little bump in the top of your back, that kind of rectangular raised bit in your shirt. You're like, oh yeah, he's a player.
Right, that rounds off your fascinations. I'm more pleased to have you now, Max. It doesn't feel like I'm doing you a favour now. I feel like you belong on the Football Clichés podcast. These are good choices.
I've got round the trial for kind of Charlton Athletic under 13s, and I've got through to the next round.
Yeah. Well, you're up at 5 a.m. to do this, which is even more appreciated anyway.
Absolutely.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Brought to your ears by The Athletic. This is Football Clichés.
Right, welcome back to Mesut Haaland-Dix with our guest, the currently Las Vegas-based YouTuber, Max Fosh. It's time for your irritations now. You seem like quite a cheerful sort. You don't seem like the sort to get irritated by anything, but give it your best shot.
No. I do have a few things that I genuinely kind of get frustrated with. the top of that list are when players have museums of themselves in their house. Now, I'm not talking about like a couple of your accolades, although there is a separate conversation to be discussed about when they have the actual sized Premier League trophy in their living room rather than just kind of like a miniature replica. Like, that's a separate conversation. I'm talking about player. I mean, this is all stems because I recently saw Zinchenko hired an artist to paint a huge mural of himself in an Arsenal shirt in his home gym.
Right.
Right. And like, this poor artist probably slaved away for hours at this. Yeah, I mean, imagine showing somebody round your house and you kind of get to the basement, you get to the home gym, and it's like, yep, this is me in my current strip. I mean, that if he moves again, which players do move quite a lot, I'm not discussing how likely it is for Zinchenko to leave Arsenal, but that poor artist is going to have to come back in and change it. And it's just getting worse. Like, players are kind of turning their houses into wings of the V&A. Like, I heard, I remember hearing that Nani used to have a statue of himself in his own house. I just think, when will this madness end? Just stop. Like, maybe this is quite a British sensibility, is of trying to be quite humble and be like, I did win a few things in my time. But it just, I think you can still celebrate your achievements in the wonderful game of football without having a full-size mural of yourself painted.
I mean, there are sort of less impressive ends of this scale, Max. There was, of course, the infamous situation where Brendan Rodgers had a painting of himself in his rented house as Liverpool manager. I mean, that feels quite sort of a charmingly low-key end of the spectrum. It doesn't feel too puffed up, does it?
Yeah, I think that's just about okay. I mean,
it's still weird,
look,
though, isn't it?
It's weird. Yeah, no, it's definitely weird. It's still on that you'd walk in and say to yourself in your mind, like, oh, that's a bit weird. But it's not kind of like levels of like mural levels downstairs in the home gym. So I think that's okay. I mean, that's not any different from kind of having a photo of yourself and your family. Yeah, not having your family
that's
in the
true.
Painting as well does it's that's also quite odd. But look, I'm not against kind of players like you. Sometimes they have like cabinets, a trophy cabinet within their house. But I think it's got to be within a contained area, and it cannot be. Especially like trophies. Like if someone's got a trophy of the actual size of the trophy, and also where do they get these trophies? Like they must have to get it commissioned by somebody.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely.
Or do they get given one? Surely the FA is not giving out 11 FA Cups every year, or 15 to how many the squad is.
Oh, I don't think they do them for FA Cups. I think the FA Cup is too treasured, isn't it, Nick? I'm sure they don't do sort of willy-nilly replicas of the FA Cup, do they?
It's old school medals all the way for FA Cup, surely.
Oh, yeah, it's old school medals. Yeah, of course it is.
Just to get a grip of this, Max, at what point does, you know, a humble kind of mid-range Premier League footballer's kind of trophy room, essentially, become a home museum, which is what your real gripe is?
I think if there's shelving.
Right.
If there's shelving, or also if they've organised them into the various different components of their career. So you've kind of got your boot and shirt wall. You've then got your balls, and then finally you have your accolades, your medals, and your trophies.
Oh, so the implication that you're being taken on a journey like you would do in an actual museum, like chronologically. I was at the Natural History Museum, and you sort of going through the millennia. Until you get to the present day. So it's a bit, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, it should be.
But to be fair, I think they can push through. They can push through this to the other side and make it absolutely fantastic if amongst all of that, they had a guided audio walking tour. If they had that, then I would completely remove all of my hatred for a home museum, because I think that's just so extra and so above and beyond. I thought, you know what? Yeah, fair enough.
I think that you mentioned the shirts there. I find it quite endearing when like top level footballers have like the framed shirts of other top level footballers, because there is a sort of, there's a kind of humbleness to I don't know, you know, Mo Salah has got Messi's shirt on his wall.
Yeah.
Mo Salah is one of the best players in the world, but on some level, he's also, I played on the same pitch as Lionel Messi, you know, and this is his shirt. Just me, I played with Messi.
Well, I mean, But by extension, I mean, we asked our listeners kind of the vital elements of a player's home museum or whatever, you know, comes below that in the pantheon of self-promotion in your own home. But Alex Mitchie says, a top player with a match-worn shirt of a distinctly average player on display and vice versa. So, I mean, as soon as the balance gets tipped even further, Nick, you're in real... Like, does the... I mean, I always wonder, when you see a certain level of player like Messi or even Salah, to be honest, swapping shirts with a kind of distinctly lower calibre operator, where's that shirt going to end up? I mean, there's a chance it'll just be given away for charity, but are they taking it home? Are they going to contemplate framing it?
Classic football shirts, probably.
Yeah, this maybe.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
But Nick, to your point, like, I don't begrudge a player having a shirt because I agree it must be incredibly, you know, you've grown up watching this person play, and I think it's very important. And I think it's nice to have, you know, a couple of them framed. But a match worn shirt of a player you've played against belongs in a shelf on a cupboard that you rarely go into, and you open the cupboard when Soccer AM are doing a piece around your house, and you kind of wistfully, oh, let's just go have a look, and you kind of like laying them out on the bed with a few small anecdotes for each shirt. I think that's where the real worn match shirts come into their own, kind of like, almost like you've forgotten that you once played against Gianfranco Zola in the early noughties.
Yes, yeah, but I see that there is this kind of added humbleness to that. Could that not come across as a bit sort of, oh, this old thing? I just keep it in a drawer. Yeah, it's not really a big part of my life.
I don't think we've quite reached a consensus on how shirts should be presented. I mean, the accepted situation, Nick, is that they're just put in a frame on a wall,
yeah.
Which, you know, it can be quite elegant to look at, but you're missing out either the front or the back. And that's a struggle to me. The humble hanger appears to be too humble for these situations. So Adam has written in, he says, a match-worn shirt on a constantly rotating mannequin. That's the way to do it. If you've got real money, Max, that's where it should be done.
I mean, or yeah, if you want to do the budget version, you kind of like very carefully cut the shirt in half vertically,
right,
and then print both halves,
yeah,
in a printed case.
Yeah. Good shout. I really enjoyed this from Jason R, Nick, who says that there should always be an unopened Barclays champagne bottle, which is really the unheralded filler content for a player's kind of memorial room, isn't it?
It's got to be signed. There's got to be a signature with a gold pen as well.
Mm. I wonder what players do with those, with the sort of player of the month trophies or player of even man of the match trophies, because
yeah,
they are shit.
They're just shit now.
They just look like a kind of like plastic yellow neon painted
aftershave
thing.
They look like sort of aftershave. Yeah. You kind of open it and the bottle's inside. But yeah, they're not mantelpiece friendly, are they? They're pretty. They wouldn't really fit. Even, I mean, you think about the classic Premier League footballer's living room. We're talking all silver, quite ornate. You know, sometimes unnecessarily so. Then you get an ultra modern kind of fluorescent award set on the mantelpiece. Nick, it doesn't work.
No, and it also would also only sort of carry any currency you've got absolutely loads of them. If you've just got two, you've just got these kind of, as you say, crap aftershave bottles sitting somewhere. You need, yeah. If you've got loads of them, that conveys a status. Mm. You think, well, you've won this loads of times. You must be brilliant. But yeah, couple, just not doing it.
Right, Max, that is a deep enough dive down the snidey rabbit hole of shaming footballers for wanting to remember their own careers. Your second irritation of football, please.
My second irritation of football is when, during a goal celebration, when a player gestures to their teammate not to interrupt what they're doing,
mm,
and just to let the player do their own thing, there's always somebody that ruins that moment. So they kind of like wave at the kind of like player, no, let me, I've had this planned for ages, and then, you know, the central midfielder jumps on their back and screams, come on. I think it's really frustrating, because especially with defenders, because they would have thought about this moment for many years, and they finally nodded one home from the back post and they had a whole routine planned only for it to be cut short by an over enthusiastic teammate. It really frustrates me.
I tell you what really gets my goat about this, Nick, first of all, is, I mean, first of all, it's quite an unsociable thing to do, is to shoo people away while you're celebrating a goal in a team sport. But it's the act of signalling that I find quite distasteful. It's like sort of gesturing people to go away. What is the universal? I'm trying to, I mean, no good for a podcast, obviously, but it's a held out arm. It's not a motion. It is literally just one arm saying, no, leave it, wait. And I find it's too much. It's disgusting behaviour.
So you're kind of flipping that. You think that's the bad behaviour. So I think Max was saying the people that are trying to kind of interrupt.
Well, that's a secondary thing. I'm going to get onto that in a moment because I have a different bugbear with this. But first of all, I just find the act of shooing your teammates away, I mean, whilst quite necessary for the purposes of relaying the information to them, still quite awkward.
And then there is obviously if someone does insist on putting their arm around you, there is the kind of the physical taking off of the arm and, you know, throwing it off kind of thing. Yeah.
I think by that point you've kind of got to accept defeat by that point.
Yeah.
Like they've got you. Don't be doing that. I mean, there's the other one. If you're going fast enough, you're running fast enough, the kind of almost like slalom, the dodging and diving, they're almost like sidestepping their own teammates.
It's like rugby league. You know, the thicker the gauntlet becomes, Max, there is a point at which they do get caught by teammates who just will not be perturbed from this. And again, it's quite an awkward situation because it's usually quite a really sort of violent tug of the collar and they get dragged back as if they are, I don't know, again, a little bit like rugby league when it gets really desperate. And someone's going to get hurt one of these days. It hasn't happened yet, but there's going to be some serious whiplash situations.
And then they have six teammates jumping on top of them as well. Like that's got to hurt. Yeah.
I do worry, Nick, that there is a critical mass at which, you know, sports science has moved on and they look at every nook and cranny of physical performance. Sometime, at some point, they're going to crack down on players leaping on top of each other while one is on the floor at the bottom who scored the goal. Because once you're past four or five, as any experienced childhood bundler will know, you're in real trouble.
And how would they have to sort of designate someone on the bench to kind of be on the touchline and run on the pitch and stop grabbing people by their necks and throwing them off? No,
we've reached the maximum. Get the stewards to do it. Poor bastards. Oh dear. Right. And then of course you have the kind of subsection of this, Max, which is when a player doesn't want to shoo everybody away, but only wants to celebrate with a certain teammate. So he shoos some away, but then accepts the congratulations of others, which is awful. Like, it's really horrible.
That's got to cut deep. That's got to really cut deep between some of the members of the team.
It's dreadful. I think the only time I would allow it, Nick, is if a player shoos all his teammates away and then goes and celebrates with a physio, which is officially a nice touch.
Yeah. Or there was a goal where someone scored and he ran straight over to the manager, and usually in those circumstances, you know, big bear hug or something like that, the manager looked completely disinterested. That must be even more kind of
well, the physio's
dispiriting.
Like, I didn't do it.
That's awful.
Yeah,
that's got to be one of your worst. What do you do? Just go to the assistant manager and try your luck there?
There was just a sort of half-hearted hug, and then he ran off again. So he's not only has he kind of pissed off his teammates by being all teacher's pet and going, no, I'm going to go and celebrate with the manager. The manager snubbed him.
Yeah. That's bad.
You're eventually there with a guy with a set piece folder, the laminated set piece folder, going, oh, cheers, mate. Hope you enjoyed it. That one's
well,
for you,
mate. Yeah, they go back to the guy. They go back to the guy with the board and point down at like the instructions that you gave. Like, yeah, good instructions. Yeah, we did well there.
Right, now we're on the touchline. That it seems a pertinent place for your third and final irritation of football, please, Max.
This actually, yeah, when a manager shouts at the fourth official about a decision that the referee has just made as if they had something to do with it. Like, now, the fourth official plays the same role in this every time when they're being shouted at, which is often, it's kind of like a flat palm, calm down kind of motion.
Yeah.
And like the person I can see doing this is Craig Pawson to Antonio Conte.
It's always Craig Pawson.
Craig Pawson. And so, like, and everyone knows kind of the fourth official's job is just to do two things. It's the substitutions and yep. sometimes act as tech supports when the referee's comms are down. It's not to be shouted at for something that they didn't do. And, like, what is kind of the manager's point here? It's like, often, like, do the fourth officials go, yeah, I don't agree with that decision. I don't think that was a foul. Like, what are they expecting the fourth official to do? March out on the pitch and say to the ref, actually, do you know what? Yeah, I think that was a foul.
Nick, it's very much the tipping point in this situation of the fourth official role either being the easiest job of the weekend or the worst. Because I think that's a cushy little gig. I don't know, maybe I'm at Brighton, they won't give me any bother or something like that. And then it's, the problem is in this situation, the fourth official is essentially the second port of call. The Furies manager has shouted at the ref, who's clearly not listening to him because he's got a job to do. And then the lightning rod becomes the fourth official. And as Max rightly points out, they can't really say they disagree with the decision. So they have to kind of do this kind of oof kind of face, don't they?
I mean, yeah. Are they kind of like explaining the intricacies of the laws and saying, well, actually, I think the referee's given that because of rule? Yeah.
It's one of those conversations, Max, I really want to lip read because I would fully back a fourth official in this situation just to not even calm the manager down, just to stop him and say, look, mate, this is the law. That's the first thing. You've got it wrong. And secondly, what do you want me to do? I feel like, you know, to pick up on your main point here, that they should be a bit more kind of officious about this and say, look, mate, what do you expect me to do at this point? I can't influence the decision. I'm not the ref. I feel like it's the easiest kind of fight back that we can, you know, the officials can begin against the lack of respect that we all bemoan.
Yeah, I mean, because also they must be able to have a few stock responses because they're probably being berated with the same stuff every time by the manager. It's going to be every fucking time. Yeah. That's his fourth offence. He should get a yellow for that. And so I quite like the idea that they're kind of like a stand-up comedian in the sense they start to get they have these things so many times they just get stock responses that they know are gonna get a reaction.
Another little kind of subgenre situation in this scenario, Nick, is that fourth officials are often and want to be quite low-key figures. They sort of take a kind of sort of background role behind the dugouts. They're not really called upon often for these dramatic situations. And because of that, when things do get a bit hectic, I swear some managers forget that they're there right until the last minute. So they're remonstrating with the ref, as I've already said, and they run out of steam there. And then suddenly they realise the fourth official and they sort of dart back in the other direction, run over to them. They think, yeah, you could have tried that first, mate, as futile as the whole thing is. But it's amazing the change of direction like a Pep Guardiola can do when they realise there's another person that they can go to. Like they're being shoved around like a call centre or something.
There's also a kind of less frequent but arguably even more undignified option, which is if they try and berate the linesman as they go past, but they're moving, so they're just kind of oh, Lino, what did you give that? And he's gone. He's off down the touchline. So they're just shouting at nothing.
They do sometimes do a shuffle. They do sometimes commit to a shuffle if they're really really angry. You will see them kind of almost kind of mimic the linesman's kind of left to right strut down the sideline whilst shouting in the back of their head.
I don't think it's possible for a human being to ignore someone and yet quite clearly be taking everything in that they're saying than a linesman being berated from behind by a manager. I think it's an incredible act of discipline from a linesman not to turn around and just say, look, fuck off, mate. Just get out of it. Clearly, I've got an offside to give in about 3 seconds' time. You just do one. But yeah, I'm glad you didn't do one, Max, despite your Las Vegas Wi-Fi. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, we got through it in the end.
Yeah, we did.
We got through it in the end. Thank you so much.
This was
thank
good.
You so much for having me. Genuinely, this is a favoured podcast of mine. So thank you very much for all the work you do looking into the minutiae of football. It brings me no end of joy.
A favoured podcast of mine. That is going to go in the promotional materials one day. Thanks to you, Max Foss, all the way from Las Vegas. Good luck with whatever nonsense you're working on there. I suspect you are going to embarrass someone or cause someone some serious inconvenience, aren't you?
Well, no, that's not for me to say.
Okay.
I just focus on the day at hand and try and get the job done.
Nicely put. Thanks to you, Nick Miller.
Thank you.
Thanks for everyone for listening, and we'll be back on Tuesday.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.